Last week, we began this brief series. It's just about a 3, maybe 4 lesson series. It may go a little bit longer than that. But that's just trying to keep each lesson from being too long in and of itself. But we've begun this brief series on suffering. I want you to know that as we look at this, we are looking to the goal of the end of suffering, to a time in which this could cease to be. That's something that man, I think, would long for and looks for, a time in which we would not suffer. But nonetheless, we are. There is suffering that takes place. There are pains, there are aches, there's trials, there's evil things. People do bad things, and people receive the blunt of those things. They receive the consequences of the evil even that others do. And as we look at that, we would recognize that because of that, we suffer as that result or the result of that. I also want you to know that I realize that these are not answers that those that are using the idea, well, if there's a God, there's an all-powerful God, then and a loving, all-powerful God, then there shouldn't be any suffering whatsoever. Because if He's all-powerful, then He could end it. And if He can end it, if He doesn't, then it comes into question whether or not He's all-loving. And we will touch upon those a little bit, but that's not necessarily the goal that I am seeking to reach. I'm actually talking to those that trust in God, believe in God, believe that God exists, that He is all-powerful, and that He is all-loving as well. But have an understanding that God has reasons, or there are things that we might not have the mental acuity nor the cognitive depth to be able to, you know, to be able and drill down into and to understand that an all-knowing God could and does understand. But God has given us some insight into this and into suffering, and that's what we would like to look at as we trust God. And we want to hear from God. We want to know more about this. We want to have some insight into this. And most certainly, the best insight that a person could have is from a heavenly perspective. That's God views this. And the Bible is a heavenly message. It is a message from God, from the God of heavens. And so it then gives us, as a biblical perspective, a heavenly perspective as well. Now, a great deal of our insight into suffering and adversity can come from our first lesson, comes from last week's lesson. And just briefly, last week's lesson was that God suffers as well. God in the heavens, He has certain anguish. There are certain things that He suffers with. And we looked at some passages of Scriptures, how that God, as He deals with the events that take place on earth, that those things grieve God at heart. That God is hurt at heart. That God suffers at heart regarding certain elements and things that transpire in man's life. And then God took on flesh. God became man. Now we know Him as Jesus. And as God became man, Jesus lived among men, Jesus suffered. And we saw that then, that God, when He became man, that He suffered as well. And so God understands suffering even from the standpoint in that He Himself has suffering. So we find that a great deal of our insight into suffering and adversity can come from that first lesson by looking at that and asking the question, you know, why God suffered when He became man. And as we look at the suffering of Jesus, we can see even without deep theological reasoning that He came and He suffered as the result of not of His own doing or even of His own sin or even of what He Himself accomplished, in life, but that there were things that transpired outside of his own life. And so we find that Jesus suffered because, as he said in John chapter 7 and verse 7, he said, "The world cannot hate you, but me it hates, because I testify it that its works are evil." So we find here, is hate something that's bad? Is hate something that's wrong? Is hate in general, or hate of certain things at least, is it sin? Can hate be sin? Can hate become sinful? Well, we find that most certainly in the case of Jesus, that one of the reasons that he was persecuted, one of the reasons that he was beaten, one of the reasons that he was hung upon the cross to die, and he was treated cruelly, and we looked at last week many of the things that he suffered, they came because man hated him. And most certainly, in order to treat man the way that Jesus was treated, out of hatred, we would recognize and we would say, well, hate is wrong. And so hate is sin, isn't it? So you see, Jesus actually suffered as a result of other people's sins. As people sinned toward Jesus, as they hated Jesus, we find then that they treated him evilly. Pilate, who looks at this not from the same perspective that we might from heaven, but most certainly as a perspective from man, and even as a worldly man, even Pilate could identify this. When it says, "For he knew," the "he" there is Pilate. And so here's Pilate judging Jesus, and he's going to, of course, pass down then the judgment of condemnation, the judgment of, you know, we'll take him out and crucify him, take him out and execute him. Nonetheless, Pilate realized that the reason why Jesus was standing before him was because the people brought him there out of envy. It says, "For he knew that for envy they delivered him up." And so once again, we see here that because of a sinful condition in the people that lived among Jesus, that Jesus taught, they hated him, and then they were envious of maybe his knowledge. Maybe they were envious of what they saw as he described his relationship with the Father. Or maybe they were envious of how people followed him and how people liked him and how people looked at him and thought that he was, you know, a teacher of God's law. These rulers who they themselves are supposed to be teachers of God's law. Maybe they were envious of, you know, his popularity. I don't know for sure what all they were envious of, but most certainly we would recognize that especially envy, that would drive somebody, and that's one of the ideas of envy. You know, jealousy carries with it the idea of, well, somebody has something that you would like to have, you know, that you want, but you don't have, and you're jealous of them that they have it and you don't. You'd go, well, I'd like to have that. And so, you know, that's not good. But you see, envy is a step further than jealousy. Envy is jealousy with the idea of, man, I can't stand the fact that they have what I don't have. And it seeks to deprive them of what they have that you would like to have, but you do not have. Now, you might seek to deprive them of it so that you can have it yourself. That is, you might go, well, you know what? They don't deserve it. I think I'll take it and I'll use it myself. But then, maybe though you would be sinful enough to envy, you wouldn't be sinful enough to steal, you see. You go, well, I wouldn't steal it from them. But it sure would be good if somebody else did, and they didn't have it. And so we rejoice at the loss that someone has of something that we would like to have but can't have. And so envy rejoices over the loss of something. So you see, when they envied Jesus, they sought to deprive him of something that he had that they wanted. Whether they would take it themselves or whether they'd just simply rejoice in the fact that someone else had taken it from him. And so that's not good. We see now the chief council, the chief priest and the whole council sought false witness against Jesus that they might put him to death. And they found it not. And so they didn't find things to actually accuse, or they accused him of things, but they couldn't find evidence of the things they accused him of. But it says, and though many false witnesses came, but afterward came too. And so they lied about Jesus, in other words. And so here's Jesus suffering beating, suffering being picked on, being slapped, being humiliated, and crucified, nailed to a cross, as the result of other people's sins toward him. So it's obvious that Jesus' sufferings were because of the sinful passions of others against him. Even though he himself committed no sin, yet he suffered, you see, as the result of sin. Sin's kind of like rust upon steel. It corrupts and it eats away at that which it is using, you know, to have its existence. It's like a parasite that devours its host. That's what sin does. It corrupts and it eats away the heart and the soul, and many times even the flesh of man feels the result of a sinful behavior. And so we find the earth itself suffered as a result of sin. Because of Adam's sin, God said, now the earth, which in the beginning, there on the third day, I believe it was, that God caused it, the earth to spring forth green grass, it says, and beautiful things, and fruit trees, and things like that. Now the earth, because of Adam's sin, he says, it's going to bring forth thorns and thistles and weeds. And so you see, even this beautiful earth began to suffer under the sins of mankind. We have that Abel, who was a righteous man, who offered worship acceptable to God, offered righteous worship, though suffered as the result of his brother's sin. Not just because his brother, you know, did not worship in the same manner, did not worship in the faith as Abel worshiped in the faith. And so because he did that, now, you know, Cain or Abel has a terrible, but because of Cain's jealousy, and he slew Abel, didn't he? And so here's a righteous man once again suffering even as the result of the sin of someone else. And of course, as we have noticed as well, that here is Jesus, the innocent one, who in the flesh suffered because of the sins of men. Now that tells us something about sin itself. And that is, sin is apparently very powerful. It's so powerful that it necessitated God sending His own Son to a world in which He knew that He would be shamefully treated, that He would be beaten, and that He would be put to death in a cruel death. That's the way sin would treat God. That's what sin would like to do to God, and that's what it was able to accomplish in Jesus Christ as it came against Him. And so we see then that even God suffered in the flesh as the result of sin. So how powerful sin must be that it necessitated that God would send His Son to this earth and that He would have to die like that. And that sin would take advantage of that. And that it would kill God in the flesh that way. It was just that kind of power that God in the flesh had to endure. And so we find as we look at this that not only did He come to endure it, but He also came to vanquish it. The Hebrew writer reminds us, he said, thou did put all things in subjection under His feet, for that He subjected all things unto Him. He left nothing that is not subject to Him. But now we see not yet all things subjected to Him. But we behold Him who hath been made a little lower than the angels, even Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God He should taste of death for every man. And so we see that Jesus came and that He tasted of death for every man. And so He came and He experienced the suffering that man experiences in the flesh, but He did so for man. He did so that He could vanquish sin. We find then that He sought to accomplish this, He says, by subjecting that death even to Himself, by raising from the dead. And the point He says this is, but now we see not yet all things subjected to Him. And so here Jesus is. He has come and He has shown us the result of sin, and that brings about suffering in the life of mankind. Just as it brought about suffering in the life of Jesus Christ, brought about suffering in the life of God. But He conquered that. He conquered that in His resurrection. He conquered that in His ascension to heaven. He conquered that in that He brought forth He brought to naught him who had the power of death, that is Satan, and He even subjected that. And there are many other things He says that He has yet to subject to Him. And so Jesus showed He has power even over suffering, and yet He hasn't fully vanquished that in our lives. Wherefore it behooved Him in all things to be made like unto His brethren, that He might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that He Himself has suffered being tempted, He is able to succor or to help or to come to the aid of them who are tempted. So we can trust this, that He did conquer Satan at that time. And He empowers us to do the same. He is empowering us to also overcoming death. But until that time, we still live in a world that is suffering the consequences of sin. So Satan and sin are the culprits responsible for suffering. And even God, when He was in the flesh, had to suffer that. So let's look at Satan, who unconscionably tempts and lures man and slays him with torture and death. You know, the record of his treatment of Job is a beautiful record of, you know, how, and I say beautiful because it shows how terrible Satan is, how great of an extent that Satan would go to harm and to hurt man. I mean, he has no conscience in bringing about death. He has no conscience about bringing about suffering, about pain, about hurting people, whether physically or emotionally or spiritually especially. That would be the end result that he would hope to attain to. And so Satan would seek to do that. And all the while, just like to Eve, he goes, well, now don't worry, no one will be hurt by this. You know, just this little sin, just this little thing, and everything will be all right. You'll come to know things like you have not known them before. The flesh will know pleasures that it has not known before. The spirit, the soul of man will be given visions of insight that he hasn't seen before. You'll become like God, you see. And so Satan wants us to believe that what he offers will not hurt, but yet it is that which, as the Roman writer says, brought about the groaning of all creation. That all creation suffers and groans since the sin of mankind. And Satan came and he did that, of course, through Eve. But we find as well that he uses sinful man even now to accomplish his war on man. As John talks about in 1 John chapter 3, he says, for this is the message which you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Not as Cain was of the evil one and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous. You see, in the sin that Satan gets others to partake in, he is willing to use that sin in others even to create havoc, to create pain, to create heartache, to create suffering in the life of others, even those who are innocent or even if they are not innocent. We find that sin still brings about suffering. And he'll even use others to create suffering in the lives of others. We find that Paul accurately describes this progression of evil as men refuses to have God in his knowledge. He says, even as they refused to have God in their knowledge, God gave them up into a reprobate mind. Now what happens when that happens, when God does that? He says, now when he gives them up to a reprobate mind, he says, to do those things which are not fitting. Being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, whispers, backbiters, hateful to God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventor of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, unmerciful. You see, when man departs from God, when man leaves behind God's ideals of righteousness and that which is right and proper, and then as he progresses, as he distances himself more and more from God, we find that these kinds of things just become natural to him. This is what I do because it serves me. It serves my sinful desires. It serves my pride. It serves, you know, my wants. It serves my lust. And if anything gets in the way of those, then, you know, I will not have any natural feeling toward those. You see, God says that as man gets further and further from Him and as God gives him over to these things, these are the kinds of things that man will do. I mean, all you have to do is pick up a newspaper. All you have to do is watch the 24-hour cycle of news on TV and you'll be learning about somebody that shot somebody else, or you'll be learning about how some dictator over here killed hundreds or thousands, and you'll learn even how that some in the name of religion will slaughter many other people. You see, as man departs from God, there's no end to the suffering and the ills that we will bring upon even one another and that will come upon mankind. He says, in the beginning and starting out, knowing the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them. The sadistic evils man can and has and does commit, and that have been committed throughout history, can be traced through a progression of man's refusing God's righteousness. I know that the world doesn't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that when we are in sin. We don't want to think that it could, you know, that we could be a part of the problem. That we could be a part of the reason why suffering takes place in the life of man. Individuals that we are familiar with, like Hitler and Stalin and communistic philosophy, they simply recognize the previous tyrants throughout history. And what they did is follow the path of those. And you can go back and you can look at this historically. Like with Hitler, he introduced the people to the pleasures of sin. Now, I don't want to get into some of the description of it. It's actually very vulgar, very terrible. But if you go back and you actually look into the history, and there are some documentaries that you can even watch to do this if you don't like to read about these things so much. You know, reading sometimes get pretty heavy. But you can get it, you know, in an hour or two of this. He began to separate the people who would follow him by introducing them to pleasures of sin. And then as he introduced them to the pleasures to sin, he began to eliminate the belief in God among the people. And so once people became separated from God through the pleasures of sin, and then even began to lose their faith that there even exists a God that they could follow and accomplish for him and others the terrible deeds that they did. You know, even among the Christian religion, there is a history, and a lot of times people like to throw it, well, see, Christians did this too. And sometimes in the history of Christian religion, there were those that did terrible things. But you know how they did them? The same way that Satan used Hitler and Stalin and these other people to do these. They said, you can't understand the Word. And so we're not even going to give you God's Word in your own language or in a language you can speak. We're going to keep it in this language. And we're going to be the only ones that can read it. And we'll tell you what God says, you see. And God says that if you want to go out and you want to indulge yourself in these sins, that's okay, but you need to come and confess those to us and pay us for them. And then we'll pray God on your behalf, and God will forgive you, and we'll give you our blessing, and then you'll go to heaven, you see. Yes, there were people, but that's not what God's Word proclaims. That's not in God's will. That's not God's righteousness. You see, in order to have and create the sinful sufferings of man, you have to eliminate God. You have to take God out of the picture. Or you have to change God. You have to make God into something that God is not and get people to believe in that, you see. You can see that progression in Paul's letter to the church to the churches of Galatia, because he's wanting them to understand that that type of ideal works throughout not just the history of man, but it can also work even throughout Christians in the church. He goes, speaking of Jesus, who gave Himself for our sins, that He might deliver us out of this present evil world according to the will of our God and Father. Now, do you suppose Satan is happy with man being delivered out of evil that the world that we participated in when we lived as the world lives? You suppose Satan is happy with that? You suppose he's just going to let that happen? Oh, well, God got one. You know, okay, I'll just let that go. So you'll just go off out there and you'll get to be delivered from this. He said, I want you to realize this, that God is the one who delivered these Christians there of this. But then just a few verses later, he says, I marvel that you are so quickly removing from Him that called you in the grace of Christ into a different gospel. You see, some were already working to dilute God's power in the life of these Christians. Satan wasn't pleased with God delivering man out of His power. And so he's going to get those to try to pervert, try to change God's Word so that God would be displeased with them. Like Balaam, when he told Balak, he said, I can't curse the people of God. God won't let me do that. He says, but I know how you can get God to curse them. Because you see, God won't be pleased with them if they go off and worship other gods. And here's how you can get them to go off and worship other gods. And so they sent their daughters among them. They said, hey, big boys, you know, here, come over here. We're having all kinds of fun worshiping our gods, worshiping our idols. And the Israelites kind of like, oh, okay, you know, let's go have some fun type of thing. And so Paul's saying, you see, that same thing works even today. And so he's marveling that there were those among them who were already trying to dilute the faith of God in these Christians. He goes on and he says in the third chapter, in the first verse, he's so foolish, Galatians. Who did bewitch you? You, in a sense, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was openly set forth and crucified. And so he says, the gospel came, was preached among you, and you heard it, and you believed it, and you knew that Jesus had died on the cross for your sins, and yet somebody comes in, and they start making up a bunch of baloney, and you know, all these kinds of strange tales that are not true about Jesus Christ, and you go after that, you follow that, you believe that, after you knew what Jesus Christ had done. And so he moves to the fifth chapter of Galatians and he says, "For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, for these are contrary the one to the other, that you may not do the things that you would. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousies, wraths, factions, divisions, parties, envyings." We see then that he warns that even Christians can be deceived and then they can be enticed. And he says, but that's what you learned in the flesh. That's the world of Satan, you see. That's what he has provided. You know, that's what he does. And then in the sixth chapter, he calls upon them not to be deceived. He says, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever man sows, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth into his own flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that sows into the Spirit shall the Spirit reap eternal life." You see, God's not mocked. Bad things will happen with bad deeds. There are consequences to sin. There are consequences to evil. There are consequences to departing from God. As man moves from God and God gives him up, then man's going to go about and he's going to do these evil things. And he says, God's not going to be mocked. There's going to be results for that. And sometimes even the righteous, even the innocent, those that are no longer practicing those things, they are going to suffer the consequences of those. You see, when we read or we hear on that 24-hour news cycle about someone going in and shooting someone else, many times the one that's shot, the poor person, is just simply trying to get away or simply trying to avoid or simply trying to keep from, you know, the craze that the person has gone to that would actually come and kill them. And sometimes we look at that and we go, well, you know, if only we could do this, or only if we could, you know, and I'm not up here promoting, you know, buying guns or owning guns or anything else. I'm just simply saying that this mentality of, well, if we could just make sure that nobody ever had any guns, then this would happen. This wouldn't happen. Or, you know, if we would just take and we would even execute the people who do those kinds of things. You know, if we were just tougher in our laws and punish those who would do such evil things. Now, the irony of both of those, even though they're actually opposite views, one view is, well, we're just not being tough enough on crime. And the other one is, well, if we just took away everything by which a person commit crime with, then, you know, there wouldn't be any crime. Well, there's a little bit more to that than what we might think. But nonetheless, if we just then take away guns, you know. Well, you know, Cain, I don't think, had a gun when he killed Abel. That wasn't the problem. Whatever Cain smote Abel with, whether it was a rock or a tree branch or whatever, still it was Cain that was the problem, wasn't it? And a lot of the people who commit these acts, you can't execute them because they execute themselves. They commit suicide. And so how does stronger, you know, punishment to someone... See, neither one of those is the problem. The problem's a heart problem. The problem is a sin problem. The problem is it's someone who has given themselves over to evil. It's the problem that someone has given themselves over to the god of this world. The problem is that we have taken God and we have gotten far from Him. And we do everything we can. Even the people who want to cure the problem are many times the same people who want to take God out of the equation and don't want to have God in the equation. and are creating the problem. You see, the problem isn't God. The problem is the lack of God. Visual Mangualdi does an excellent job of showing how the Bible, and in particular the gospel of Jesus Christ, elevates civilization and how evil progresses when truths are suppressed. He's written a book. It's The Book That Made Your World. And it's a thick read, and it's kind of a hard read at times, you know. It gets kind of, you know, in there, and it's kind of hard to keep interested in it for a little while. But if you stick through it, you'll find that he historically documents when people are living by the righteous standard of God versus nations and peoples, when they put away God out of their society, the evil and the changes that are done in it. And so it's shown, it's demonstrated that the problem is not God. That's just who people like to point the finger of blame at. We point our bony finger of indignation at God. And most don't want to hear it. But that is that when we do that, we're not wanting to accept our own culpability. Like Adam when he said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." And so Adam wants to point back at God. "Well, God, you're the one that gave me this woman anyway. I mean, me and the animals, you know, I had the dog here, and I had, you know, even me and that beast of the field, we got along all right. You know, we had no problems until she came along. And she didn't come along until you thumped me over the head and took a rib out and went and made her for me, you know, type of thing." And so we're just a whole lot like that. We find that Jesus says over in John the 8th chapter, as recorded there in the 44th verse, he says, "You are of your father, the devil. The lust of your father it is your will to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and stands not in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own. He is a liar and the father thereof." Now there's one other passage I'd like for us to consider here before we make any comment on that. And he says, "And we know that we are of God, and the whole world lies in the evil one." He calls in other passages the evil one the god of this world. Now, when man doesn't live up and doesn't accept his problem of sin, and that sin creates, as it did from the beginning, havoc, it creates suffering, it creates sorrow, that it corrupts and that it destroys. But instead says, "Well, God somewhere must be at fault, because if He's all powerful and if He's all loving, we wouldn't have to have any of this." The problem is, this man's pointing his finger at the wrong God. He's right. God did do this. The God of this world. And his offspring, as Jesus said. When he said, "You are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father," or the desires of Satan, "his will it is your will to do." And we've seen how that ends up. He is the God to blame for suffering. And those denying Jehovah God, making fun and belittling the intelligent faith of those who do know God, are actually aiding Satan in bringing misery, suffering, and the eternal loss of the souls of mankind. Like I said, I know that this message could only be preached to those really who have a comprehension and understanding that God exists and wants to know a little more about what's all of this that's happening, and why is all this pain, and why is there all this heartache in this world? And we would accept God's perspective from heaven as He has viewed it and as He sees it and as it takes place. And we can come to a better understanding of it. Doesn't mean that we still don't suffer. It doesn't mean that we still don't want deliverance from suffering. But as we saw there, when it said that Jesus suffered, but we haven't seen yet all things that will be subjected to Him, that there will be an end to suffering. Just don't have time for it this morning. That is to consider the lesson anyway. We all have time for it at the end, right? But there will be, and God will bring an end to suffering. But his question for you now is, or maybe not as much a question as we see it as his invitation, but the question is what would we do with God's invitation when he says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." Now that God has given us a little insight into it, and I realize we've had to just kind of paint the big picture, and I realize that it doesn't answer necessarily all questions like tsunamis and tornadoes and things like that, but it does. It's just that we didn't get a chance to get into those, because after the fall of man, as we saw there in Romans chapter 8, all of creation then was subjected to this vanity. And so things are not working the way that God put them together as He created the heavens and the earth there in those first 6 days. But as the result of sin, even that first sin, and then even as the result of man's individual sins today, we find that there are consequences. That God is not going to be mocked. That what a man sows, that he shall reap. God simply invites you to sow these seeds of righteousness, to find this rest that is in His Son, Jesus Christ. That's what He offers. And that's what we extend. We extend the invitation of Jesus Christ this morning. If you are subject to that invitation by your faith in Jesus Christ, if you have turned from sin even and haven't confessed that faith, we would invite you to do so this morning. Maybe you have turned from sin and even told people that you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God. God bless you for that confession. But have you been buried with Him to die to the death of sin, to raise with Him in newness of life, by the burial with Him in baptism, to raise up into a new life in Jesus Christ, and to walk faithfully with Him throughout the rest of the days of your life? We invite you to accept that invitation of His and come to know the deliverance from this present evil world, and to come to hope for the end of suffering, even your own, all suffering, as God brings it to an end. We invite you, come as we stand and as we sing.
All to Jesus I